You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Andy Kirkpatrick's first podcast. I'm Andy Kirkpatrick, and I'm currently in an unidentified Arab country, and I'm walking to work. The reason I'm in an unidentified Arab country is where I live is very strict. You can be deported for almost anything. You can be you can go to prison for bouncing a check or having a girlfriend. You can so it's unidentified. So I'm on my way to work. I work as a writer. So going to work is going to sit in some kind of coffee shop or anywhere where you can sort of lurk. I don't work very well at home in like a quiet space. I think I have like attention deficit syndrome. So like if you have a kid who like Ritalin and things, it's like a stimulant, I'm told. So if someone's kind of hyperactive, if the brain's hyperactive, if you stimulate them, then it calms them down, which doesn't really make much sense to me, but that must be why I like working in kind of busy places. Luckily, if you live in the Arab world, there's a mosque, there must be a mosque every, you know, what's that thing, like there's always a rat like 10 feet from anybody or something. So here there's always a mosque. I'm not saying a mosque is like a rat. There's always a mosque, probably within 500 metres of anywhere when you live in sort of an Arab city, Muslim city. So the mosque generally wakes me up at about 4:30 in the morning, where you're supposed to get up and do your thing. I don't know if people really do. I've got quite a lot of friends who are Muslims, and they tell me that they do get up and pray, but I kind of find it hard to believe. But anyway, it just kind of wakes you up and you sort of got that kind of half awake sort of state. Then the alarm goes off at 5:30, so it's not like super, not like you get a big lion. Get up at 5:30, I don't really have breakfast. Then I make my wife for breakfast, and then I get out of the house by about 6:30, 7:00. And everything is so hot here. It's not hot at the moment. It was like 50 degrees when I got here about 4 months ago. So most people seem to get up early and get on with the day. And most people, like when we first got here, it was like a ghost town. You never really saw anybody apart from in the evening. Like if you went down to the sea, you would see like whole families out. Like it was like, you know, like down at the seaside, but it would be 10, 11 o'clock at night. That was the only time you could really start moving around. But it was just hellish. It was like being in a science fiction film. Like, what's that film? Pitch thingy. Anyway, that film with Vin Diesel. I think it's called, they have that, go on that planet called, so I'm just trying to cross a road. They go to that planet called Crematoria. It was a little bit like that. But it's kind of cool. It's like having a, you know, when you have, if you're really into really spicy food, it's like being in a really spicy country. Like it's actually exhilarating or exciting to walk somewhere when it's 50 degrees. And I think the first day we got here, Vanessa actually cried because it was just so goddamn awful. The place we live is a total shithole, and the area we live is a shithole as well. We live in an area where it's primarily Bangladeshi, Indian, like sort of non-native population. And I think in most of these Arab countries, probably less so in like Egypt and places, but you know, the native population are like 20-30% of the population. So it's you know, a lot of these countries have a lot of money, but it's, you know, like an amazing amount of squalor. And you know, it's like some people are making, you know, huge amounts of money, and other people are making like almost nothing. So yeah, it puts all these people talk about privilege and all that kind of stuff back in Europe, and it's good. It puts all that stuff into perspective, which is the perspective that it's all bollocks. So I'll probably talk more about living out here another time. But I seeing this is my first podcast, I don't really want to. I'll probably talk about climbing sometimes, but probably, I'll probably just interview some other people, have like conversations with some good climbers. Like that's if this whole podcasting thing works, this might just be terrible. But I've put it off for a long time. Like I always like to think I'm quite sort of good at spotting trends and being on Twitter and all that kind of things, you know, like for everybody else. But for some reason, the podcasting, I've kind of put it off because it's, I don't know why, but I just have. Like my kids have been telling me to should start doing podcasts for forever. Mainly because I say a lot. Because it's not written down. I've got no script. So if you don't have a script, you tend to say a lot. So I do apologise. I need to sort of hold something really sharp in my hand. Every time I say I'll just squeeze it. I'll get one of those shock collars. Maybe we should bring out a shock. Maybe do it on a Kickstarter. Shock collar for public speaking. Every time you say which is, that's probably the same thing, that you get a little electric shock, which would be quite good. So, well, on the subject of public speaking, I thought I'd start with. I thought like maybe talking sometimes about non-climbing related things, but things about, like, the reason, like, I have a very unusual life. Like, not most people don't go to Starbucks every day to work, unless you work in Starbucks. The reason I go to Starbucks every day, I do go to other places. I go to Costa's, I tend not to go to like places which are either too small, because you tend to sit there all day long, or you know, because you can sit in Starbucks all day long, no one really cares. I do often say though, if you're going to make a living as a writer, and you're going to spend a lot of time in coffee shops, you're probably better just working in a coffee shop, because you know, you don't make, it's kind of a lifestyle choice being a writer. Like I'm actually quite a successful writer, and in terms of writing for like a niche audience, I probably do make enough money to say that's my, you know, that's my job. But it's probably only because I don't really spend any money, and I live a very frugal life. I live in a country where you don't pay any tax, which also, because when you live in, I was last place I was living, in Ireland, and Ireland's actually got some good advantages if you can be categorised as an artist, then you don't pay any tax under like 50,000 euros, which sounds, people might get upset about that, but most artists are making like 12,000 euros. So if you're a Bono, you probably have all your money somewhere else anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But like the economies of being a creative person are pretty tough. So if you're like most people are spending about 50% of their income through various taxes. So if you're only making, you know, like I probably make on average about 12,000 euros a year as a writer. Because I could make a lot more than that if I could be asked to write for magazines and things. I probably make the same amount of money as a writer as I made 20 years ago when I was writing for magazines and, you know, used to sell words to sort of Patagonia or Black Diamond and people, and you'd be getting like a dollar a word. Most magazines, you were getting like a penny a word. So I used to write gear columns for High magazine, and so I probably made a pretty good living as a writer, you know, as an old-fashioned kind of jobbing writer. But those things have kind of changed now. And after a while, you know, after a while, you just can't be asked doing it, really. It's kind of, I really enjoy writing blogs and things because you can just write what you want and you have no limit. There's no like editor or, which is a good thing and a bad thing, because some of it's just that terrible. But you can just kind of riff. Can I say the word riff? And you just kind of riff on, you have like an idea, and that's probably, as it Steve Jobs said, you have to, the big thing in business is not what you do, it's what you don't do. So if you have your own blog, you can write what you want, you can go off on like really small kind of tangents. And at the moment I'm trying to finish a book, and that's kind of, it's hard because you have to really knuckle down and finish a book, and you'd just rather write your own musings about various things. Like every day you probably have a little idea about something you'd like to write, and it's quite nice when you have the time. When you've got the money in the bank, then it's nice to just write what you want to write. It doesn't really matter if everybody reads it, but it's just kind of there. But I thought today I was going to talk about sort of public speaking, because that is probably my primary like form of income, and that really is what subsidizes writing for me. So if anyone doesn't know who I am, I'm a climber, part-time climber, full-time dreamer. I'm a climber, a writer, and I have like a reputation as like one of the, I won't be humble. I did a slideshow in Finland last week, and said it was the best slideshow they'd ever had at the festival. So I'm kind of known as being a raconteur. I can get on stage and talk about things in an interesting, funny way. But yeah, I should own it, because I've been doing it a long time. So if I was still shit at it, then I really wouldn't be doing it anymore. So I know some people do. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about my life as a as a speaker, stand-up comedian, motivational person, thought leader, Tony Robbins. No, I'm not. So I just thought I'd talk about that because it's kind of interesting. Because I'm always really interested in, like, when I meet people, I'm always asking them what they do. I'm a little bit obsessed about asking people what people do. It's just really fascinating, like, how do people make a living? And in the, it's a very kind of English thing, is that people never ask, you know, how do you make a living doing that? How much money do you make? Like, I did a slideshow in Hungary, you know, and everyone is like totally open, like, how much money do you make? How much money do you get from this book? And how much do you charge for this lecture? And people were really sort of direct. But most geniuses have come from Hungary in the 20th century. So, well, that's that you don't have to be a Hungarian to be a genius, but it helps or something. Anyway, so I think it's really good to talk about to people's expectations of how much money you're going to make doing something, because often people look from the outside at people having like what lives that look like really, really amazing, but you often don't really realize how impoverished they are or the sacrifices that people make to have those kind of lives. Like most comedians, you know, most comedians who are on the television are really pretty skint. You know, everyone's like working towards that, the big break. But for everyone who makes it, there's like, you know, 999 who didn't. So I remember something on Radio 4. It was the singer from Stereolab, which was like a band. Really, it was quite a cool band. A band used to like, you know, in like the 90s. And it was saying how, you know, you're in your head, you're imagining this woman is off somewhere, like touring still, you know, doing music soundtracks or whatever. But in fact, she was getting a job on the Eurostar, just working on the Eurostar, which was really, you know, you had this different, completely different impression. Basically, music just didn't pay the bills. So she just had to get a proper job, which must be really terrible. Like, I know friends who are actors who have just spent their whole lives just waiting to get that role in, you know, Game of Thrones or something. But again, it's a much more practical, some of these podcasts are much more practical looks, looking at how you make a living, an unconventional living, which for me, I think, like, an unconventional living is basically how most people will be making a living. Like, I'm basically a hustler. That's what I do for a living. I just hustle. And if you go to, you know, you go to Africa, you'll find that most people are hustling. And I think that's where the world is hustling. The kind of European model of, it's good if you can work in the public service, but most people can't. So most people, you know, increasingly have to do lots of different things. So my life as a motivational speaker is, it's a strange thing to become, because I think back to my older, to my young self as being quite shy. You know, one of these kids who didn't like, you know, didn't even like going to the shops, asking for some sweets or whatever. So I feel like I have this impression that I was very shy. But a lot of these impressions we have of ourselves, completely wrong. My mum would tell me that I was like a real extrovert and I had loads of friends and I was always like the leader of the gang and all this. So we I think it's a thing we have to be really, really wary of, is the stories we tell about ourselves are generally, you know, just shite. So I have this impression of being kind of shy. Like, they would call me suboptimal at school. I would say I was a retard, but I was really not good at school. They didn't have any debating societies. They probably had like masturbating societies, but didn't have any debating societies or any or anything like that at the school I went to. And if you kind of go through school just feeling like you're a total idiot, you know, really, really stupid, your self-worth, maybe I was more confident when I was younger, but like how school can have a great effect on people in a negative way of making them feel pretty worthless. So, luckily for me, one of the first jobs I had, I got a job in a shop. I moved to London and got a job in a shop called Survival Aids in Euston Station, which was a sort of outdoor shop, sold stuff like the military and survival people. Sort of, I was like pre Bear Grylls. It was more like Lofty Wiseman. I could probably do a whole podcast about working for Survival Aids, and I'll one day. But so I was working in this shop, and you know, you see yourself as quite a timid person. I didn't like ringing people up, whatever. And the very first day, you know, the manager is like, "Oh, can you ring this customer up?" You're like, "Ha ha," and to not want to be humiliated is a really good tonic for many things. So you just have to ring this person up, this complete stranger, and talk to them, and having to speak to customers was, you know, you just had to do it, and slowly you kind of learn the art of being a salesman. And now everyone is a salesman or a salesperson. I'll call it a salesman. I was born in the 1970s. I can't change everything in my head to fit the 21st century. So, because being a salesman is, you know, you're either selling yourself or you're selling a product or you're selling an idea or you're selling, you know, you want to sleep with someone, you want someone to employ you, you want to marry someone, you want to all these things. So you're always like selling something. So I think a foundation in retail is a really, really great thing. And a lot of people I meet who are very kind of good at communicating, as in you say, "Oh, this person is a solid kind of person," and that you can, you know, that you interact with them really, really well. Often they worked in shops when they were like teenagers or whatever. So that kind of found, you know, when you meet people who are, you know, like a professor of mathematics, they generally didn't work in Primark, and you can sort of tell really. So yeah, so a foundation in selling is a good thing. Because when you're selling yourself, or selling something else, a lot of it is about, well, it's basically about communication, but it's about sort of like, you're kind of flirting with somebody in a way. Like you don't want to be like the, you know, like if you know someone's selling you something, you're just naturally resistant to it. So often in retail, the classic thing is someone comes in and you say, "Do you want any help?" And people automatically say no, because no one, you know, most people don't, even if they want help, they'll say they don't want help. So that's a negative straight away. So you just have to wear it a different way. Like you just have to say, "I'm just over here. If you want anything, just give me a shout." So that's not much, because then they say, "Okay," which is a positive. So this is kind of very basic kind of salesman technique. So, but their expectation is that you, the person selling, is a person who wants to sell them the most expensive thing. You're just there to basically rob them and sell them something, you know, sell them something they don't really want. So you have to sort of subvert that, and you know, you tell someone, "You don't want to buy this, it's not suitable, or this thing here, which is cheaper, is actually better, and this is what I use." Like, that's one of the most important thing. "This is what I have." And you think, well, this guy works here, he can look at this shit all day long. Like, if he has it, it must be good. And I think one of the best car salesmen ever, he used to say that he wasn't selling them this car, he was selling them the next car. which is a really good way of looking at it, really. So working in retail was interesting, and you realised that you had to be funny, you had to pass on information, you had to keep people's attention, you had to read their body language. So all these things like came into play later on, like when you're standing on in front of like 2,000 people, like talking about your holidays. I also was lucky in that my mum is a good sort of storyteller, and she would always put on these like stupid voices, and you have all this she, instead of saying like, oh, this person said, oh, you can't do that, Sue, it's like you're too poor, she'd be like, and then she said, oh, you can't do this, Sue, you're too poor. You would like put all these like stupid voice on for all different characters, and I can see my kids do the same because I do it. So we're telling a story was kind of handy, but also because when my dad was in the Mat Rescue, RAF Mat Rescue, in the Air Force, and I think the people in the military, I think they must have a lot of time on their hands, because he spent a lot of time sitting around. They're a bit like roadies, basically, like militarized roadies, in that they're actually very interesting people, because they just spend a lot of time sitting around, reading books, very well read, like soldiers. And so they're good at telling stories. You know, there's a real educational aspect of storytelling. There's a lot of people in the military, like if they were, you know, Harvard, you know, quality, Oxford, Cambridge, quality, potential students, then they probably won't be in the military. So the way of learning is very, very much, I'm exactly the same. Like I can read a book, I can read like, you know, chapters of a book, and none of it goes into my brain until the subject matter is tied into a story, and I'll remember that forever. So you'd be, you know, often you'd be sitting around and there'd be some guys like telling a story about some incident, and through listening to them you sort of learnt about like timing and, you know, having an end point. And I remember just being a kid trying to join in with these conversations and trying to tell a story, and like halfway through you realize that you were on hiding to nothing, like you didn't really have a point and it wasn't funny and it wasn't even interesting. So yeah, I can almost remember the moment when I had that realization, like to tell a story is actually a skill. It's not, just don't take it for granted that anyone can tell a story. You have to have a story to begin with. And if you're good, you can turn, it's a bit like being a writer. Like if you're a good writer, you can write about zip, you know, you can write a whole story about someone's zip breaking on the trousers, and you can make it into a great story. Where other people, they can have, you know, they can go land on the moon, they can make it boring. So it's a skill, basically. So all these things were kind of foundations of a future life talking about yourself. So I was working in another outdoor shop. Basically, just worked in outdoor shops. I was working in an outdoor shop. So remember, like I didn't go to university. Didn't have any qualifications. You know, I was on the dole until I was like about 19. So I didn't have a lot. I didn't have a lot going for me. So I was working in this outdoor shop called Outside, and I'd been to the Alps and I'd done my first alpine route, which was a winter ascent of a route called the Frendo Spur, which was completely changed my life. Absolutely changed my life. This climb, it led to me becoming a writer. Led to all sorts of things. It was a complete epic, and that. Like my climbing partner never climbed again afterwards. But there was an ice climbing festival, and this shop was in a place called the Peak District, which is, it has no peaks. It's like a joke, it's like a British kind of humour. Let's call this place with no peaks the Peak District. I think it's a way of like getting foreign tourists to go there. So it's, you're doing an ice climbing festival. There's no ice. There's ever been any ice. There might be a bit of ice on the road somewhere. So we had this ice climbing festival, and my boss was like, "Do you want to go and do? Do you want to go and do? Do you want to do a slideshow at this ice climbing festival about climbing on Climb the Friend Us Bear?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'll do that." And I don't know why I said I would, but I said, "Oh yeah, I'll do that." And I guess by then I've been working in the shop for a few years. So I was kind of confident speaking to people. So I got my slides together. This was the days of like slides, carousels, or, you know, physical slides, analog slides, would you call them? And I think the other speakers was Andy Cave, who wrote Learning to Breathe, which is a great book. And maybe Chris Watts was there, maybe a guy called Rob Anderson. They were doing slideshows. And then I was like a warm-up man. And I had to do like 20 minutes of it. So I put my slide thing on there. I didn't really feel any fear whatsoever. And I put the slide on the slide machine, walked up into the front of the room. There's probably about 40, 50 people there. And it was like amazing. It was almost like it wasn't me. It was like, you know, like the Manchurian Candidate. It was like somebody else suddenly took over my body, and I just started like talking. And I was like talking, and it was funny, and people were laughing, and I was like just saying what came into my head, and it just seemed to be funny. And maybe I'd told these stories already, like in the shop, like talked to customers, probably bored them to death talking about it, because this climb was so intense, such an intense experience, that I probably thought about it like every 5 minutes for about a year afterwards. So anyway, so I just talked for 20 minutes, and it was like an amazing experience. It was a little bit like, you know, when you're a kid and you go to a disco, and you know, you don't dance, and then you start dancing, and then it's like the most amazing thing to be dancing at a disco, and after that you just want to go dancing the whole time. It was a little bit like that. It was really like, wow, this is amazing, I got to do this again. So after that, I like took every opportunity I could to just stand up and talk about my adventures. So I was talking about, you know, I went to Patagonia on my first kind of trip. I went to try and climb like Fitzroy in winter, and went to Yosemite, climbed the Shield, some various routes on El Cap. So I had like more and more stories to tell. So it was a bit like being a DJ. Like when I grew up in Hull, and I knew a lot of, before I left, knew a lot of like people are DJing, and you could see how people would like link all their music together. So it had like a, you know, it wasn't just like record. It was like, you know, actually was going somewhere. So I had all these stories. I could start talking about, oh, in the last year I went to Patagonia, and I went to Yosemite, and I went to a trip to the Alps, and then if you had this linear kind of storytelling, and you just like knock one off and add another one on as you're going along. And slowly you started getting like climbing clubs for like, oh, will you come and do a slideshow for us about your latest trip? And by now I was like writing for magazines and things, and people kind of knew who I was. So this is before social media, so I don't know how I ever made a living without social media, but somehow I did. So I did this. So slowly, you're going from talking in the backs of pubs to people, to doing, you're talking to more and more people. Then there's like an organised event, and then you're going to climbing festivals, and eventually after several years of this, like 10 years of this, now you're there on the stage, the BAM Film Festival. You know, it's Saturday night. 2,000 people, you've kind of, apart from like appearing at TED or something, you know, you've really kind of made it as a speaker. And one of the most important lessons I learned from watching other people was not to make the audience feel uncomfortable on your behalf. So I saw a few slideshows by a guy called Jim Curran, who's dead now, but he was a real great like raconteur. Like one of the most famous, it's not his story, but he went on a trip to Trango Tower, and he lost so much weight that Mo Antoine said to him, like, "Oh, Jim, you're the self of your former shadow." Is that right? You're the shadow. Yeah. So anyway, a really good speaker, but every time you saw him speak, something would get fucked up, like his slide machine would stop working or something would happen. And he just took it really badly. And it was very, you know, it was really uncomfortable. And what you realize is that there's a huge amount of goodwill when you're speaking in front of an audience. And if you're a professional, then probably not, but you know, you're an amateur, you're a climber, you're not meant to be a great public speaker. So people have a lot of goodwill, and people will laugh about, people are on your side, they'll, you know, they want to enjoy themselves. They're not sitting there, unless you're in Aberdeen, but like Dundee, I mean, people want to enjoy themselves. They're so you can say things which aren't even very funny and people will laugh, but they're just desperate to enjoy it. But they won't enjoy it if you're having a massive meltdown and you're being like, just taking it badly when something's not going well. So I learned that from Jim Curran. So I had a few disasters early on, and it was how you. So a good example of this was I asked to do a talk in Shrewsbury, so I had to drive like 2.5 hours to get there, and I was always a little bit late. Like being early, being on time is being early. Basically, that's my motto now. But I grabbed my gear, threw it in the car, my slides and everything. Drove to Shrewsbury, which was 2.5 hours away. And when I got there, the audience were already there. There's like 160 people all sitting there waiting for me to do my thing. And the steward who organised a lecture, he was sitting there at the table with all the, you know, giving the tickets out to people. And I went to get my slide projector, my slide carousel out of my bag, and all that was in there was my gym stuff. And I was like, oh Christ. I was like, but I tried to look like it wasn't a big deal. I was like, oh, Stuart, I've got a bit of a problem. He's like, what? I said, like, I forgot to bring my slides. And Stuart, he just like put his head down onto this table. And I'm like, but don't worry about it, Stuart. Like, have you got any slides? And he's like, what? I said, have you got any slides? He said, yeah, yeah. I said, well, you can get your slides and I'll do my slideshow using your slides. So he looked very confused. I was like looking like it wasn't a big deal. So, you know, so that's very important to sort of bluff that you're not really shitting yourself. So anyway, so he went off. So I went to the thing and I realised I'm going to have to do something. So, because he probably lived away. So I ran to my car, and in my car, in the olden days of analogue, you had slide film and you had to cut it up and put it into slide mounts. And I didn't have any slides. I did have some like ends of slides like in the boot, which had just been left there, like some litter, which was just black with a tiny little bit of colour that had bled into it. So I had some slide mounts, so I had enough for four black slides. So I cut these four black slides out and put them in the mounts and put them in a carousel and went in and I put it on the slide projector and I was like, hi everybody, we've got a little bit of a problem this evening and I forgot my slides. And everyone's like, ha ha, they all laughed. And that's a start. And I said, but don't worry about it. Stuart's gone home to get his slides and I'm going to do my slideshow with his slides. And again, hey, that's so funny. I said, but before that, I'm just going to use these four slides I found in the back of my car. They're just black, so don't worry about it. So I just started talking with these four slides, and within like 1 minute, I'd use all four black slides. So I just started going backwards and forwards. I was like, oh, see this slide here? It's all black. I want you to imagine that this is actually, you know, the super cool one on Fitzroy. So anyway, everyone's enjoying it. And it's actually, I owe this, part of this is that I remember Mark Twight saying how, someone had said they'd seen Mark Twight and he did a slideshow without any slides. He just sat on a stool. And he just like told the story, and I remember thinking, like that's a sign of a really good performer. So I did this for like half an hour, 40 minutes with no slides, and then Stuart turned up. So I was like, okay, we'll have a break. I'll put Stuart's slides in. So everyone had a little break. They all came back, put Stuart's slides in. The first slide that comes up, it's a Fontainebleau, like bouldering in Fontainebleau, and I'm talking about climbing in Patagonia in the winter time. So there's a picture of Stuart in his shorts and his like rock boots. I'm like, oh, see this photograph here. Imagine instead of rock boots, he's got plastic boots on, and it's like instead of like a 20-foot-high boulder, it's like a 2,000-meter-high granite face. So it went really well. And at the end, I said, next year I'm going to come back and I'll do the slideshow for free, and I'll bring my slides next time. So the next year I came back, did the slideshow, and had all the slides. The same people came. And at the end, I'd finished. Everyone clapped at the end. And at the end, this old guy came up, and put his hand on my hand, and he was like, he said, oh, it was much better last year. So being able to sort of bluff your way through and not make people feel uncomfortable is a really, really important skill in many things. And I've used it the same in like on you know, trips, expeditions and things where basically everything's fucked and you just have to make it look like it's not as bad as people think. So probably one of the funnier versions of this story is that I did a slideshow in London in a cinema, and halfway through I had a really, really poor quality computer, and halfway through just the screen just went black and it just came up like disk error, you know, closing down, the computer closed down, and everyone was like, because everyone's thinking like, oh my god, the poor bastard, like his computer's stopped working. And I was like, don't worry about that, I don't need that, I don't need the slides. So I just kept on talking. So again, so I'd had this experience of not having slides before, so it wasn't, I could deal with it. So anyway, so I'm talking, then all of a sudden the computer comes back on again, and someone in the audience had actually gone up into the projector room and managed to reboot the computer. So the computer came back on, and everyone was like, hey! And I was like, oh yeah. So do you know what? There wasn't actually anything wrong with the computer. I just said that because I wanted you to all to feel like what it feels like when you're out of control, and it's how you deal with these things. That's what really matters. And I was like, fucking hell, that's so clever. Anyway, I pressed the next slide and the computer switched off again. So all these things are kind of important skills. Like when I finally made it to the BAM Film Festival, you know, amazing, I've made it, this is my big break, you know, BAM for all these people. And I had this like I'm not very good at preparing these kind of things, so but I did prepare, and I had I'd done this really, really cool bit of music. I had, you know, that film, like that song by Johnny Cash, that kind of one love kind of song. So I had that, and I had it with like a montage of like images. It was going to finish my slideshow, and it was like so good, and everyone's going to be crying. Oh yeah, this is going to be perfect. Like I'm going to make them laugh, I'm going to make them cry, and all that kind of stuff. So I get to the end, and almost the end, said, I just want to finish with some music. I had them in the palm of my hand. You know, they're like, God, this guy's amazing. And I pressed play, and nothing happened. Basically, what in the slideshow, there was a bit about crossing Greenland, and there was a wind sound, but the wind sound, it was for some reason it didn't stop playing, so it just kept playing and playing and playing. So the technician had had to turn all the sound down on the slideshow. So although Johnny Cash was singing, he was singing within a big windstorm. Anyway, so no sound came up. I'm just standing there, and everyone's like looking, and these slides coming on. I was like, fuck, what am I gonna do? I just have to start singing. So I started singing, and I was like, oh, here's a person in the cold. Oh, he looks like he's having a bad time. Oh, da 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 da. And I just started like, here's a mountain. And I just started having to sing for like 2.5 minutes while these slides were showing. And everyone was like in hysterics, and they were laughing. Anyway, and afterwards we were like, oh God, that was hilarious. Like, God, how do you think you're doing something like that? And I was like, it just didn't work. I just had to improvise. And like, oh no, that was definitely, you know, that was all planned. So maybe don't be, you know, don't be afraid of fuck ups. So on that front, I was doing all these festivals and things. And every year I'd try and tour around, and I would try and make a living like talking to like universities and, you know, climbing groups and stuff. But I remember did like a tour, and it was just a little mini tour, and it was just terrible. Like no one came. Like, I realized that climbers were fucking the worst people you could ever try and make any money out of, because they just were unreliable. They wouldn't turn up. You know, they were just, oh, I went climbing instead. And, you know, then they'd be bitching and moaning that you charged them any money whatsoever. They'd try to get in for free. It was just like a waste of time. So, but I'd done a slideshow. Like, I'd done quite a lot of slideshows for, like, mountain rescue teams or, you know, like, charities and things. And what you realise was often they just take the piss and they wouldn't put any preparation into getting anyone to come because you were free, so it doesn't really matter if no one turns up. But you're not free to you. You know, you're having to drive for 5 hours to stand in front in a room where no one's there. So the Buxton Mountain Rescue Team had asked me to do a slideshow to raise some money. And I was like, I'll do it, but I'll only do it if we can get the Buxton Opera House. And I'll get Ian Parnell, who's a, you know, a really good climber at the time, and we'll go like 50-50, like me and Ian will get 25% and you get 50%, but like we could get like 2,000 people, they have to pay like 15 quid, you know, it's like a night out, you know, and it was really, this is the way we're going to do it. And I think they ummed and awed, but they thought we could pull it off, and we did, and we got like, you know, 1,000 people or whatever, all paying loads of money. Like me and Ian made, like, it was like really good for us. It was really good for the mountain rescue team. And people might think maybe that's a bit mercenary, but that's how you make money for people, is by doing a good job. So that made me realise that there was actually an audience out there that weren't like spotty teenagers in a, you know, doing like engineering. So I thought, like, I either have to give this up, or I just need to do it better. So I guess that's been probably the way I've kind of looked at most of the things I do in my life is, you know, can I do this better? If not, I'll just have to not do it. So I decided I had to get an audience who weren't climbers necessarily. Climbers could come, but, you know, you have to get people who were like, you know, mums and dads and, you know, just ordinary people. People who are like interested. Like, I'm not interested in airsoft, but I sometimes watch videos about it on YouTube when I'm bored. You know, I've never even fired an airsoft gun, but I find it kind of interesting, like listening to people talking about running around in some German forest firing at other people. So, you know, so there's amazing, you know, an outdoor, a lot of people are interested in, you know, armchair mountaineers and read all these books and stuff. So I thought that's what I'll do. So I did the first tour, and it was like really successful. You know, it was successful as in, you know, you had like 200-300 people coming and they were paying like 15 quid. So the cut of a slideshow is the venue gets 30%, then you have to give, of that 70%, you know, you're going to have to give a certain percentage to, you know, your marketing, blah, 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 all these things. So people think, you know, you're going to see a good example was Prince. So Prince, you know, you go and see Prince, and the ticket was really expensive, and it was, the place was full, but Prince actually didn't make any money because he had too many overheads. And once when I was touring, Grease the Musical had sold out in all the venues I was going to, and then they cancelled it because they realised that although they'd sold out, they were going to make a loss, so they just cancelled the whole thing. So the economy of it is, you might have to, you know, people like, oh God, look at you, you know, you're in the big time now, but you've just had to pay like £10,000 in marketing to do this tour, and if it doesn't work, you're totally fucked for life. So people don't really see those kind of things, the risks you take for this kind of stuff. So but I ended up starting a company called Speakers from the Edge, and then I started touring other people around, you know, like Simon Yates and Mark Bormann and all these kind of people. So then it was interesting because you were seeing how other people did it and the mistakes people made, and you realised that you were, I don't know if expert is the word, but you kind of knew quite a lot about this business of adventure speaking. So when someone says, like in Finland, this is like one of the best, you know, presentations we've seen, it's kind of, it's not surprising if you think how long I've been doing it. You know, it should be pretty good by now. But teaching other people is interesting. You learn a lot. You learn a lot by what they do right. You learn a lot by what they do wrong. You realise that some people, you have to pay them to stand on the stage, and generally they're not that good. And some people, they would pay you to stand on stage, and generally they're good. So I remember like an interesting experience was being asked to go and speak to Chris Bonington about his slideshows and how to it. Like, so this Chris Bonington wanted me to do this, to talk to him about how to make his slideshows better or, you know, more contemporary or whatever. So that, you know, it's a bit like Chris Bonington is, you know, some Victorian people did this kind of thing, but, you know, he really is like one of the, you know, the fathers of this kind of game. And I remember like we're sitting in this tiny little study of his, like full of books and boxes of slides. Like Chris is like an amazing person. Like it's very easy to scoff, you know, about Chris Bonington because, you know, he was very successful. But he really is like an amazing person. Like absolutely, if we chopped him in half, he'd die. If we chopped him in half, inside there is like an absolute real climber in there. So we're doing this, so they're going through the slides and I'm like, Chris, like in the slideshow, you're addressing all these things, but you never really address all the people who have died. But basically almost everyone you're talking about has died climbing. And Chris stops for a minute and then he's like, well, when I climbed Everest in like 1980, whenever, I did have this feeling when I was on the summit of these people being, all these friends being with me. And as he said it, he just started crying. And he's there, like just me and Chris Bonington, and Chris Bonington's crying. And I'm just like, oh God, pull yourself together, man. And I didn't realize at the time, but Chris is actually very good at crying. Now, I don't know if this is actually a technique, but that is a really good technique. But don't cry all the time, because that's just pathetic. But being able to demonstrate a really deep emotion is really, really incredible. I can remember once, it wasn't a slideshow, it was someone, a writer. He was a really good writer. But listening to writers talking about writing can be a bit boring. I just tend to switch off a little bit, because unless it's actually telling a story, if it's like a general thing, I just kind of switch off a bit. And he was talking about going like skiing with his son or something. And in this room, everyone's sitting there, he's talking about skiing with his son, and his son like doing this, like barreling down this steep cliff. And I was kind of half listening. And then he said, like a year later, my son was like killed in an avalanche. And in that moment, like every single person in that room, they were like 100% listening to what he was saying. And it was like really, really intense, like when he was talking about his son, because he was on like I feel like I'm going to cry now just talking about it, but he was right on the edge of just not being able to speak. And that is like really, really powerful. Like, you know, I think it was David, I can't remember now, but I'll never forget like him talking about his son. Like his son is like embedded in my brain now forever. So emotion's kind of important. So I eventually sold, Speaks from the Edge actually eventually sold my, I ended up working with other people and I ended up leaving that business. And now Speaks from the Edge still exists, and it does a lot of really good, a lot of people in the UK will have been to their events, and that's who I still do tours with. It's kind of weird, you start a business and then you end up, you know, then you're still touring with them, even though you're not part of it. So anyway, so another aspect of this is talking to kids. So I really, really, always really, because I was such a suboptimal student at school, I've always been really interested in education. I've got like two kids of my own, full set. And so, started doing talks for schools and, you know, public schools, private schools, primary schools, colleges, all this kind of stuff. And that's really interesting. That's a really good way of becoming a better speaker, because kids have a very, very low threshold of boredom. So I think a child's attention span is its age plus two, maybe. You learn lots of good things about, you should never really try and engage with the kids. Because, you know, primary school kids, because they'll all start yabbering along and, you know, they'll all get hyper and, you know. And the way a child's brain, like I think I have a bit of a child's brain. Like I always say a lot of things which I shouldn't say. And I think that's kind of a, you know, something to do with, I have a part of my brain that is not fully developed, which manifests itself as, like, people might say it's dyslexia or whatever, but there's a part of my brain that isn't developed. It's the part that deals with risk taking and everything else. So it actually makes you a more interesting speaker, because you're kind of edgy, because it's very hard for me to control what I'm, you know, whatever comes into my brain is probably already out of my mouth before I realise it. So one of the things I always loved with, like, kids was the, when they ask you question and answers. And so I remember once I did a slideshow about Greenland, and one of the kids was like, how did you breathe if there's no trees? Which is quite a good question. And then one of the kids was like, did you come back? Which is a very good question. So, and then you'd always get the kids who would ask a question that another kid had just asked, and everyone would be like, he just asked that question. And so it was really cool. And then you always have that kind of, the bit where the headmistress or whatever comes up and says, well, thank you, Mr. Kirkpatrick, for coming here and speaking to us all today, and shall we all give a nice big round? And he's, oh, that's all, it was interesting. Because I have this kind of, this dyslexia kind of label attached to me, I'd often end up talking to, because I wrote this book, Psychovertical, and there's a bit in there about dyslexia. So you'd often get invited to talk to schools where they have, you know, they've all these problem children. And I remember once giving a talk at college, and they really focused on having lots of dyslexic kids in there. And it was like a prize day or something. And I was like, oh, congratulations, kids, you're so lucky, you've been born different, you know, whatever. And I remember all the parents like, oh my God, that's not true, my little Timmy, he's severely disabled. So I don't know if it was a darker side of this kind of thing, is I end up talking to a lot of, like, bad kids. You shouldn't call them bad kids, but they are, they're just little bastards. So, like, kids who were, you know, they were just bad. No, they weren't bad, but they were just, you know, anyway, they were bad. So they were just kids who were just bad. So I remember did a talk in St. Albans, and I think it was quite a rough school. And I don't know why, like people often say, like, oh, because I'm black, people always profile me as being, you know, I'm gonna rob them or shoplift, whatever. I think coming from Hull, I have a similar problem. Wherever I go, I often seem to get into trouble. The police, I've been stopped by the police a lot. I was, like, in a university recently, and I was, like, stopped by the security and asked what I was doing there. I was actually there to have, like, a probe stuck on my arse to look into hypothermia, how you deal with hypothermia. But that sounds like you kind of make it up if you say that to the security guard. But anyway, but because I look a bit dodgy, I seem to get these jobs of being asked to speak to dodgy kids, which is quite cool. So I give this, I was giving this talk to this class, this assembly, and I was like talking. I was talking about climbing in big walls in Yosemite or wherever, and then one of the kids says, like, sir, do you ever wank on a big wall? And anyway, the whole class, the whole assembly were all, like, in hysterics and just, like, laughing. And one of the teachers, like, marched along to look down the row of kids to, like, shout at this kid or get him out. But the teacher was laughing so much that he couldn't say anything. So I got my revenge in that this photograph came up. I said, oh, this is my girlfriend. And everyone was like, they're like, sticking their hands up. I was like, yeah, she's dead now. And everyone just, like, stopped immediately. And I was like, I'm only joking. And so I then ended up, like, doing these, I started going, talking to these kids in, like, secure units, where you'd only have, like, 10 kids, but you'd have, like, 10 assistants, you know, 10, like, teaching assistants, which were, like, you know, like those, like big hoofing dinner lady kind of women who were there basically, you know, like, as a prison warden, and all the kids were all kind of locked in these, like, in this I think it could, I don't know if you call it a school, I think it was like a special units for kids And what was always interesting about that was they'd always say, like, don't worry if they start kicking off. Like, just don't worry about it. Like, we'll sort it out and it's nothing to do with you, whatever. And the kids never, ever kicked off. And I found this in a lot of schools. They'd say, like, did you notice, like, little Timmy the bastard, like, the one who's a bastard, you know, he didn't do it. He just listened to you really intently, like, he wasn't distracted or whatever. And I think one reason is that I speak really, really quickly. I find it hard to moderate how quickly I speak. And a South African guy once said to me, people just have to listen quicker. So, and I don't know if, you know, like I said at the beginning of this, is that if someone has attention deficit syndrome, you stimulate them, and that makes them be normal. So maybe that's the thing. I don't sound like a teacher. I'm not saying teacherly things. I'm often saying things which are not clear, so people have to think about them. And so that was always something I really enjoyed. Like, the one place I have never actually, when I got a spot, I've done a lot of work with, like, the military. I've done work, you know, with all sorts of kinds of people. The only place I've never been is a prison. So if there's any prison people out there, not prisoners, for God's sake. You're probably too busy on your Xbox anyway. I'd be interested to speak in a prison. Probably do like a concert or something. And then the last part of this puzzle, the Kirkpatrick life in standing on a stage, is motivational speaking, or demotivational speaking, I like to call it, because it always seems a bit shite, like me standing up on the stage and, you know, talking about my life. I once did a talk for one of these, I don't know what a blue chip company is, but this was like one of these blue chip companies, like a huge. Anyway, a very big company. And I was talking at the beginning about being on the unemployed, and afterwards someone said, you know what, in all my years in this company, we've never had someone stand on stage and talk about being unemployed. So, and that's kind of weird. Like, I remember doing a talk for Barclaycard, and I was like, how come you want me to speak to you here, but you won't give me a Barclaycard? Because I think my credit rating so low. I think my credit rating so low because I never had a credit card. So that's a good lesson in life. Get in loads of debt and you can have as much as you want. So, and I did a talk once, and I lost my, I had some sort of insurance, health insurance, life insurance. And after the slideshow, my insurance was cancelled. So it is kind of weird, that really. And I think I don't really think motivational speaking to businesses is actually any good at all. It's just, like someone said, if you go to a conference, it's either a holiday camp or a prison camp. And, you know, having me there to give a talk, it makes it more like a holiday camp because it's kind of funny and whatever. But the actual value to the company is companies, I shouldn't say this, seeing as I, you know, used to run a business that still makes a living, like, getting people to do motivational speaking. I think the way to do it is to actually not employ someone, but have someone who is involved in the business, as in says, like, for 1 year, I'm going to come and I'm going to talk to the staff and I'm going to be engaged with this, you know, on this. So if you're talking about risk, you know, dealing with risk or something, instead of like doing like 30 minutes on risk to a load of, you know, people, like I did like a lot of work for Siemens on risk. You know, you got like, you know, 40 minutes talking to like 40 people, you know, 40 different people like several times, is maybe you're gonna get some tiny little bit of, you know, like being about paranoid about everything and you know, maybe something is gonna get in there, but you really need to kind of be more embedded with, you know, try and change the culture. I sound like a proper business person there. The culture, it's all about culture. So the motivational speaking thing is kind of interesting, but really it is a bit of a, like when you run a business doing this and you know the people who do it, You know, some people do really well, but you, it's kind of, you'll see like a speaker bureau and they'll have 1,000 people like on their books, but really all their income comes from like 5 people. So it's very, the whole speaking, the whole sort of speaking business is just, it's kind of a it's a closed shop really. So if you want to make a living talking, then I would suggest you it's just like being a stand-up comedian. And people often say to me, oh, have you ever thought of being a stand-up comedian? And I'm told that I'm actually funnier than a comedian. Like, people have come to my shows and they say, oh, this is fun. Yeah, I laugh more at this than... It's like, you know, Mark Kermode says, like, a comedy is where you laugh 5 times. So, you know, people find it really, really funny, and it's funnier than a comedian. So they say, why don't you become a comedian? I'm like, well, are you laughing? Therefore, it's comedy. But, like, in terms of being a comedian, is that I would be viewed as a very successful comedian who's not been on the television. So most comedians you meet, they're doing, you know, gigs where there's like 50 people and they're getting like 50 quid or 100 quid, where I'm doing gigs where there's like, you know, 500, 600 people. And, you know, the last tour I did, I was like 35 theatres, like, you'll almost kill me, but you're just touring 35 theatres, doing your thing. So if you're a comedian, unless you're on the telly on some, I remember like when I climbed with that woman, Alex Jones, not the conspiracy guy, she remembers saying to me like, oh, you'd be so good on a panel show. And I was like, Christ almighty, is that all good for us, being on a fucking panel show? So but in terms of fame and fortune, unless I become Bear Grylls, I'll actually tell you the story of meeting Bear Grylls on one of these podcasts, but unless I become Bear Grylls or Ray Mears or something, then I basically, this is as far as I'm ever going to go, but which is totally fine. So I think that's probably it. I'll probably do another podcast more about the technical side of putting together a talk. But I would definitely recommend anyone, if you ever get the opportunity to stand up and speak to people, is, you know, don't watch any of my things. A lot of my things are on YouTube. But you always have to remember that there, you know, the last 2 tours I did are on YouTube. And every time you do a tour, it's better than the one before. So I look back at some of my original ones, which are, you know, like a long time, you know, 15 years old. And you're like, oh my God, like, why the fuck was I saying that? And why have I got a t-shirt with loads of fucking curry all over it? Do you know what I mean? Like, you look back and you're like, oh God. I remember I did like this TED talk, TEDx, which is not a TED talk at all. And you know, I didn't even prepare it. I just turned up and thought I'd do like, you know, like a half an hour slideshow in 15 minutes. I just talked twice as fast as I do normally, which is like really, really fast. And you know, you look on YouTube and it's like, slow the fuck down in the comments. So. But the life is full of stuff like that. Like I often look back and just think of all the stuff I've just, all the opportunities I completely blew or wasted or whatever. So, but that's such is life, you know. You basically live it backwards anyway. So, I shall hopefully I didn't say and air too much in this. And this is actually the third time I've recorded this. So the first time I recorded it, and didn't press record, and the second time I recorded it, I just said too much because I didn't know what I was going to say. So hopefully, third time's a trick. If you enjoy this podcast, then share it, give us some comments, give me something to talk about next time, and I'll try and post them like every Friday. And is that like a cock crowing? That's actually just a sound effect I put on to make it sound really exotic. I'm actually in Barnsley at the moment, in a travel lodge. So anyway, thank you for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.